Sen xandru l-ewwel parti tal-lecture li ingħatat minn Father Daniel Madigan bit-tema Is Dialogue with Islam Possible in Europe? Nisimgħu l-ewwel parti ta' din il-lecture.
Since the oil crisis of more than three decades ago and the Iranian revolution, Islam has become more and more assertive. In the post-September 11th world, the more fanatic and extremist elements of Islam seem to have acquired a stronger voice. At the same time, our knowledge of Islam is sketchy at most, and we easily perceive Islam primarily as a threat, a growing threat to peace, a threat to our Christian culture, and even to our European and Maltese identity. Yet, it is this very Maltese identity that should encourage us to be open to the world of Islam. Very often we describe ourselves and we pride ourselves as a bridge between Europe and North Africa, between the Western and the Islamic worlds. In times of peace and prosperity, a bridge is an excellent place to be. It gives you a unique vantage point, for from it you can glimpse the other side too. Yet in difficult times like ours, when people speak of a possible clash of civilizations, the bridge can be the most dangerous place. It is usually one of the places which is most exposed to violence, the place where battle is first engaged. When we find ourselves so exposed and vulnerable, our first, and perhaps the most natural reaction, is to withdraw, to ensure that the demarcation lines are drawn as clearly as possible. The Catholic Church itself also calls itself a bridge, this time a bridge between God and humanity. Since Paul VI, it seeks a third way, which is neither confrontation nor retreat into well-demarcated lines. It seeks the way of dialogue. Vatican Council II said that the Church looks at Islam with an attitude of deep respect. Not yet that we are no longer living in the heady optimism of the 60s when these words were written, but in much more suspicious and dangerous years, the Church still proposes dialogue as the way forward. We all remember when the present Pope, just before coming to Malta for his second visit, visited one of the most important mosques in Damascus as a sign of deep respect and willingness for dialogue on the part of the Catholic Church. But is dialogue really possible with Islam? Is it possible in Europe, where Islamic-inspired violence seems to be on the increase? The debate in our country on this vital issue is practically non-existent, not really well-informed, often based on fear and prejudice, sometimes with barely concealed racist overtones. With this in mind, our center decided to invite Professor Madigan, hoping to contribute to a discussion that for us is essential as it is complex, where rational hard thinking needs to take the place of emotional outbursts. Father Daniel Madigan is an Australian Jesuit, Professor of Islamic Studies and President of the Institute of Studies on Religions and Cultures at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. He began his Islamic studies in Cairo and went on to read for his doctorate at Columbia University in New York, where he was also a visiting professor. For 2 years, he was fellow in residence within the Center for the Study of World Religions of Harvard University, and he taught at the United Faculty of Theology in Melbourne and the Faculty of Islamic Theology at Ankara University. Recent publications of his include various articles in the Encyclopedia of the Quran, published by Brill, and the book The Quran Self-Image, Writing and Authority in Islam Scripture, published by Princeton University Press. I will not take any more of your time, and I give the word to Professor Madigan. After his talk, there will be time for questions. Thank you very much.
These are rather grand surroundings, but I'm very grateful for this invitation and the hospitality that I've received so far. It was nice of you to turn on the fine weather. The topic, according to the flyers of tonight's lecture, is dialogue with Islam possible in Europe? It's a straightforward question, and I'd like to begin, I think, by giving a straightforward answer, and my answer would be no. I don't want to shock you. I hope they'll still pay my my ticket if I just give a one-line answer. Why do I say that? Dialogue with Islam is an extremely difficult thing because Islam is an abstraction. If you ask me, is dialogue with Muslims possible in Europe? I say by all means. Islam, as Christianity, is an abstraction. If there are no Christians, there is no Christianity. If there are no Muslims, if there are no people who submit themselves to God, according to the teaching of the Quran, then there is no Islam, because it's a verbal noun. It doesn't describe people, it describes an idea, an ideal. And you can't dialogue with an ideal, you can only dialogue with a person. So instead of asking ourselves about the possibility of dialoguing with Islam, let's ask ourselves about the possibility of dialoguing with Muslims. An altogether different question, an altogether different answer. My one-word answer to that one is yes, certainly. Using terminology like Christianity and Islam, or talking about the encounter between Christianity and Islam, leads us to what we call an essentializing discourse. That's a rather complex word for a simple thing that we do every day. It means, once you have described this person as a Muslim, you have said everything that needs to be said about them. You treat Islam as though it is a block, as though it is a single group of people who can all be described by the one word. And that is very far from the truth. It is indeed very far from the truth that you can describe all Christians. To say that a person is a Christian, what does it mean? If I say this person is a Christian, does it mean you'll find that person in church on a Sunday morning? Well, only a very small percentage of Christians actually go to church on a Sunday morning. Does it mean that you will find that person loving and forgiving in every situation, turning the other cheek? One would hope so, but perhaps not. The label Christian, we know from our own experience as Christians, those of us who are Christians, describes an enormous range of different levels of commitment and practice and understanding. And so too, the label Muslim. You can put the label Muslim on Osama bin Laden, you can put the label Muslim on some of my dearest friends, but they're utterly different people. You can put the name of Muslim, the label of Muslim, on about 800,000 people in Italy, but of those 800,000, probably only 5% at the most go to the mosque. So what does it mean to label people and to think that we have expressed the essence of people with that label? This kind of talk, Islam and Christianity, worse still, people write books about the cross and the crescent, you know, getting even further away from the people, we've reduced them to symbols. The crescent, supposed to cover a billion or 1.3 billion people, reduce them to one little symbol. this kind of essentializing discourse, the discourse that thinks I've got at the essence of that person by putting the label on him or her, is the enemy of dialogue. And in fact, it's at the base of our fears. I was saying to someone earlier this evening, in kindergarten, you give children brightly colored blocks, and they're all of a certain size. You can't give young children blocks that are too small, because they put them in their mouths and they choke on them, and they can't manipulate them. They don't know how to build something with tiny little blocks. So we give them big blocks, and we give them single colors, and they build something which is not very sophisticated. Unfortunately, that's how our talk tends to go these days. People who comment on the world for us give us big kindergarten blocks to understand our world with. They give us a big green block over here, and a big red block over there, or a big blue block over here. You saw it in the American elections recently, you know, red states and blue states, as though everything is reducible to a single color. Now, you can't build anything sophisticated with that. But we are being fed kindergarten level visions of our world when we are adults with more sophistication than that. And we are accepting, what's more, those kindergarten level visions of our world, which divide them into manageable, manipulable blocks. You probably remember, having been subject to the British as we Australians were, you probably remember those maps in the schoolrooms, which in my time, it was already the Commonwealth, it was not the Empire anymore. But all the Commonwealth countries were colored pink on our maps. And you looked at the world and you saw all these pink areas. And you thought, oh, well, that's us. But only a few of the people who lived in those pink areas were actually pink like me. A lot of them were extremely black. Some of them were partly black. Some of them were slightly yellow. The only thing we really had in common was tea, cricket perhaps for most, and royal visits from time to time. But we treated the world in this sort of simple primary color way. We cannot afford to do that in 2004, if we ever could. We cannot afford to allow a political discourse which simplifies the world down to a kindergarten level for us. And it's that kind of discourse which is at the base of our fears, because someone says to you, can you dialogue with Islam? You say, well, it's too big. I don't know how to get a hold of it. I mean, is this Muslim here Islam? I don't know. Does she represent Islam? We have allowed ourselves to be scared, terrorized perhaps is the right word, by the enormity of this great block, which in part we have created for ourselves. It's also true that if Osama bin Laden were here and the Americans didn't know about it, he would have a chance to tell you probably about a world in which there are two big blocks as well. Perhaps his block of the loyal, proper Muslims is much smaller than the block we're afraid of. But what he is proposing again is a world which is divided into very simple groupings, all of one color. And you can very easily work out a politics and work out a military strategy, because it's simple, isn't it? Two groups, two colors. So we have to do whatever we can to deconstruct these oversimplifications. We have to do whatever we can to actually stop talking about Islam and start talking and start thinking about actual Muslims, actual people. Actual Muslims have actual names and actual histories. Actual Muslims have actual university degrees or actual diseases or actual jobs or actual families. They're very concrete people, like anyone who is not a Muslim. People are concrete with concrete differences and variations. So when I say I don't think it is possible for there to be a dialogue with Islam in Europe, what I'm saying is, let's get over Islam and let's start concentrating on dialogue with Muslims in Europe. But what kind of dialogue can we have? Traditionally, in church documents, we separate out four kinds of dialogue, which are not mutually exclusive, and none of them is more important than all the others. But we speak of a dialogue of life, the dialogue of actually living together, even if you never talk about your religion, the dialogue of just working together in the same factory, living together in the same building, going together to the same school. The dialogue of action, in which people actually get together, people of different religions get together and work for political causes, for improvement of their municipalities, their school systems, where people get together, for example, as they do in the Jesuit refugee service in Rome, where you have Muslims and Christians working alongside one another, running hostels for refugees, language schools, and so on. You have the dialogue of theological reflection, which is the kind of thing I like to do. Not that many people like to do it, but I get a kick out of it, and that's just one of my vices, I can't help it. But it's not for everybody, but it's one of the things to be done. Talk about our theologies, talk about our different views of God, talk about our different understandings of Scripture and so on. It's one of my greatest pleasures. And then there's the dialogue, we say, of religious experience. And that is a dialogue which is very richly undertaken by, especially in monastic communities. There are many monastic communities in Europe and the US which are hosting dialogues of this kind, bringing together people of different spiritual traditions, not to talk theology, not to talk politics, but to speak to one another and to practice together their spiritual lives, in the hope of recognizing some resonance, in the hope of recognizing each other as believers. So, given these four kinds of dialogue, which all have to go together in a sense, what kind of dialogue can we have in Europe? I think, above all, it must be a real dialogue. I mean, this is not just diplomacy. This is not just putting on a brave face. This is not just a dialogue in which we try to be nice to one another and then we go home and we say, oh, can't stand those people. Whatever dialogue we have must be genuine. We have to express who we are. We have to express what we are concerned about. We have to say what we believe, and also listen to what the others believe, to what the others are concerned about, to who the others are. Our preoccupations, and there are many of them, have a place in dialogue. We don't leave our preoccupations at the door and go and talk nice, and then go and pick them up and carry them home to nourish them a bit more. But given that it's an honest dialogue, we have to remember that our dialogue partners are not necessarily responsible for everything that's wrong in the world. The Muslim patient, for example, in a hospital where someone is a nurse or a doctor, is not responsible for what Osama bin Laden or Azarqawi or any number of the Saudi royal family are doing in the world. And so you don't make this poor laborer from Tunisia pay for the crimes and mistakes of someone over who she has no control. We have to be honest in our dialogue, and yet we have to recognize that this person in front of us is not the representative of the whole of the Muslim world. Who among the Christians here wants to be held responsible for the Crusades, for the genocide in Rwanda, for the who among the Catholics wants to be held responsible for the bombings of the IRA? Who among the Catholics wants to be held responsible for the Spanish Inquisition? I recognize that that is part of my community's history, but I don't expect to come to a dialogue and have to answer for it. And so nor should I put the Muslim person in a position of having to answer for all the current problems of the world, for what has taken place recently in Holland, for what is taking place currently in Iraq, in Indonesia, in Nigeria, in any number of places. So one aspect of dialogues not being diplomacy is the fact that we are not dealing with representatives of governments. You are dealing with an actual person who is probably a much smaller cog in the collective machine than you may think. If we are not responsible for everything that our communities of faith have done or are doing, at the same time we have to recognize, whether we are Muslims or Christians or Jews or Buddhists or Hindus, or let me get that out of the way, this applies to everybody, we have to recognize that we are part of a community that has done and is often continuing to do wrong. It's not enough to say they're not real Christians. Not enough to say that the IRA are not real Catholics. It's not enough to say that the Crusaders who did violence in Constantinople, for example, were not really Christian. They're all too real. I mean, that is what Christians really did, unfortunately. They are not ideal, but they are real. Many Muslims will often say, well, people who do this killing in Iraq and other places are not real Muslims. And it's true, they're not ideal Muslims, but unfortunately, they really do consider themselves Muslims. So we both come to this dialogue humbled. And that is my second major point about this honest dialogue has to be a humble dialogue. Because traditionally what has happened and continues to happen is that each side, or each person, if we're just dealing with two, tends to compare his or her ideals with the bitter realities of the other. We Christians say, well, of course, we have a religion of love, in which we don't hit back at people, we turn the other cheek, we forgive, we don't even call people fools. You know, that you would answer in hellfire for calling someone a fool according to Jesus' teaching. We are very gentle. We believe in justice, we believe in peace, and so we do. But unfortunately, that is not the truth of the way we live. We then say to the other people, well, look, you people are violent. You people are always playing politics. You people don't know how to divide church and state, or mosque and state. So we stand up on this great height of moral superiority and compare our ideals with the other people's reality. And of course they return the favor. They stand up on their great height of moral superiority and say, well, in Islam, of course, women are very highly respected and protected. But you people, look at you. You have naked women splashed all over the newspapers. feminists are writing every day about the risk they run in the workplace and on the streets of sexual harassment. Look at you. Up from that great height of moral superiority, they look down upon us in our reality. The only way to have a serious dialogue between believers is for us to come down to the moral low ground that we so richly deserve to inhabit. Any dialogue that starts with pride is certainly not a Christian dialogue. We cover over the failings of our history often enough. We're not answerable for them necessarily, but we have to be in solidarity with them. We begin, when we come to celebrate the Eucharist, we begin by admitting our need of God's forgiveness. Some years ago, I think it was 75, when the Jesuits set themselves the task of describing what is it to be a Jesuit, the first line was to say, to be a Jesuit is to be a sinner. Not that to be a really good Jesuit, you've got to be a great sinner. But it's a beginning to admit that is the fact. It's the fact for all of us, whether we're Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu. We begin not from the moral high ground, but from the moral low ground, calling our dialogue partners to that same moral reality.
Għadkom kem smajtu l-ewwel parti tal-lecture li ingħatat minn Father Daniel Madigan bit-tema Is Dialogue with Islam Possible in Europe?